was long gone.
It looks old, she said as she got back into the car. I don't see anyone around.
Big secret government place, huh? Doesn't look like nothing to me.
Long Joseph opened the door and began to shoulder his way out of the back seat.
I'm going to have a piss.
Maybe the fence is electrified, suggested Jeremiah hopefully.
You go pee on it, then let us know, old man.
Thunder cracked loud, closer now.
Get back in the car, Papa, Reenie said.
What for?
Just get in. She turned to Jeremiah. Drive through it.
Dako stared at her as though she had suggested he sprout wings.
What are you talking about, woman?
Just drive through it. Nobody's opened that thing in years. We can sit here all day while it gets dark, or we can get on with this. Drive through it.
Oh, no. Not in my car. It will scratch.
Reenie reached over and pushed her foot down on top of Dako's, forcing the accelerator to the floor. The Elosi spat dirt from beneath the tires, caught traction, then leaped forward and slammed against the gate, which gave a little.
What are you doing?
Jeremiah shrieked.
Do you want to wait until they track us down?
Reenie shouted back.
We don't have time for this. What good will a paint job do you in prison?
He stared at her for a moment. The front bumper was still pushed against the gate, which had sagged back half a meter, but still held. Dako swore and thumped his foot on the pedal. For a moment, nothing changed except the noise of the engine, which rose to a shrill whine. Then something broke with an audible clank. The windshield spiderwebbed, and the gate burst open before them. Jeremiah had to stomp on the brake to keep the car from rolling into a tree.
"Look at this!" he screeched.
He leaped out of the driver's seat and began a dance of rage in front of the car's hood.
"Look at my windscreen!"
Reenie got out, but walked instead to the gate, which she pushed shut. She found the chain where it had fallen, removed the wreckage of the padlock, and draped it back in place so it would still appear locked to a passing inspection. She looked at the front of the car before getting back in.
"I'm sorry," she said. "I'll find a way to make it up to you. Can we please just keep going now?"
"It is getting dark," said Khabu. "I think Reenie is right, Mr. Dako."
"Damn,"
chortled Singh from the pad speaker.
"I hope you'll tell me what just happened. It sounded pretty entertaining from here."
The road beyond the gate was still unpaved and narrow.
"This doesn't look like much," said Long Joseph.
Jeremiah, scowling and silent, drove forward. As they wound on through the evergreens, Reenie felt her adrenal surge draining away. What had Singh called her? Shaka Zulu? Perhaps he had been right. It was only a paint job, but what right did she have to push Jeremiah anyway? And for what? As of now, they seemed to be going nowhere.
"I smell something odd," Khabu began,
but before he could complete his sentence, they had negotiated a bend, passing into the shadow of a mountain, and Jeremiah was treading hard on the brake. The road before them had disappeared. They skidded to a stop a few meters away from a featureless cement wall that stood like a vast door in the mountainside.
"Good God!"
Jeremiah stared, goggle-eyed.
"What is that?"
"Tell me what you see,"
urged Martine.
"It's a gate of some kind, about 10 meters square, and looks like a single slab of concrete, but I don't see any way to open it."
Reenie got out of the car and laid her hand against the cold gray stone.
"No handle, no nothing."
A sudden thought filled her with gloom.
"What if it's not a gate at all? What if they closed this facility and just sealed it up?"
"Look around. For God's sake, do you always give up so easily?"
Singh's raspy voice made Reenie stiffen.
"See if there's a box or a recessed panel or something. Remember, it doesn't have to be right there on the gate."
The others climbed out of the car and joined Reenie in her search. The twilight was thickening fast, and the rain made it even more difficult to see. Jeremiah backed the car away and turned on the lights, but they were not much help.
"I believe I have found something."
Khabu was 10 paces to the left side of the gate.
"This is not true stone."
Reenie joined him. Holding her cigarette lighter's flame close to it, she could see hair-thin lines describing a square in the rock face. There was a small crevice in one seam that, although it appeared natural, might serve as a handle. Reenie stuck her hand in and pulled with no result.
"Let me try, girl."
Her father slid his large hand into the space and tugged. There was a heartening creak, but it still held fast. As if in answer, lightning flashed overhead. Then thunder and its echoes came caroming down the mountainside. The rain grew heavier. I will get the jack from the car boot, said Jeremiah. We might as well ruin that, too.
End of side 16. Change side selector switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.
Side 17. City of Golden Shadow. Otherland, Volume 1. By Tad Williams. Continuing on page 523. It took both Jeremiah and Long Joseph leaning on the jack, but the panel door finally popped open, long unused hinges grating. Inside was a small panel crisscrossed with an array of tiny black squares.
It takes a code, Rini announced,
loud enough for Martine and Singh to hear her.
Do you have a hizzy cable?
Singh asked.
HSSI?
When Rini said she did, the old hacker nodded.
Good. Pull the front of the panel off and hold the pad over where I can see. I'll tell you how to hook me up. Then I'm going to get funky.
Whatever Singh was doing did not pay immediate dividends. Once Rini had wired her pad into the control panel to his instructions, she propped it with a rock and returned to the car. The sun sank. A chill wind pushed the rain into a raking horizontal. Time seemed to pass very slowly, broken only by an occasional and uncomfortably close blaze of lightning above them. Jeremiah, despite Rini's cautions about conserving battery power, turned on some music. Featherweight but piercing pop fluff that did nothing to soothe her ragged nerves.
Why they put this here?
Her father asked, staring at the gray slab.
It looks like it's supposed to be bomb-proof or something. She looked up at the steep pitch of the mountain face above it. And they've got it recessed a little, hidden from anyone flying overhead.
Long Joseph shook his head.
Who are they trying to protect this place from?
Rini shrugged.
Martine says it was a government military base. I guess the answer is everyone.
Habu returned with an armful of wood, dripping wet, but apparently unmindful of the downpour.
If we do not get in, we will need a fire, he explained,
stuck into his pants pocket and looking somewhat incongruous beside his old-fashioned coat and antique necktie was a large sheath knife.
If we don't get in, we're going to find us somewhere decent to sleep.
Jeremiah was sitting on the hood of the car, arms crossed on his chest, looking thoroughly unhappy.
There isn't room in this car, and I'm certainly not going to sleep in the rain. Besides, there are probably jackals up here, and who knows what else.
Where are we going to go with no money?
Rini began, when a grinding noise even louder than the thunder made her start in alarm. The cement slab was sliding to one side, revealing a black emptiness inside the mountain. Singh's triumphant cry rang out above the noise of the gate's passage.
Ichiban! Got it!
Rini shut off the music and stared at the opening. Nothing stirred within. She walked forward through the streaming rain and leaned in to have a look, wary of booby traps or some other spy flick danger, but saw nothing except a concrete floor disappearing into the darkness.
Actually, that was a bitch!
The old hacker's voice crackled in the sudden silence.
I had to work hard on that! Pretty much of a brute force job. One of the old government key codes. And they were always a bastard to crack.
Habu, Rini called. You said you were ready to make a fire? Well, why don't you make one? We're going inside, and we'll need torches.
Are you crazy, girl?
Her father eased his way out of the back seat and stood.
We got this car, and this car got headlights. What you want torches for?
Rini felt a moment of irritation, but quelled it.
Because it's easier for a person with a torch to see, so we'll lead the car in. That way, if they've pulled out the floor or something, we've got a better chance of noticing before we drive Jeremiah's expensive motor into a 50-foot pit.
Her father looked at her for a moment, frowned, then nodded his head.
Pretty smart, girl.
Just do not attempt to turn anything on, said Martine. If there is still equipment here, even lights, electricity may still be connected also.
But that's what we want, isn't it?
Rini was waiting impatiently for Habu, who was kneeling beneath the overhang, using her lighter to set fire to a long stick with its tip wrapped in dry brush.
I mean, we're looking for equipment, aren't we? We have to use the stuff, and I doubt any of it runs on good thoughts.
We will solve that problem as soon as we can,
Martine replied, a measure of strained tension in her voice.
But think, if this is a decommissioned base, as my research tells me, then will it not attract attention if it begins to draw power? Is that a risk you wish to take?
Rini shook her head.
You're right. We won't touch anything yet.
She was ashamed of herself for not having thought of it. Shaka Zulu, indeed.
I will lead.
Khabu waved his makeshift torch. The rest follow in the car.
But Khabu, please, Rini.
He kicked off his shoes and set them down in a dry spot on one side of the doorway, then rolled up his pants legs.
There is little I have done so far to help. This is one thing I can do better than anyone here. Also, I am smallest, and will be best at getting through tight spots.
Of course. You're right. She sighed. It seemed everyone was having better ideas than she was.
Just be very, very careful, Khabu. Don't go out of our sight. I mean that.
He smiled.
Of course.
As she watched Khabu move forward through the gaping emptiness of the doorway, a tremor of unease ran up Rini's spine. He looked like some ancient warrior going down into the dragon's den. Where were they going? What were they doing? Just a few short months ago, this flight and break-in would have seemed incomprehensible madness. Jeremiah started the car and drove forward behind him, easing through the entrance. The headlights met nothing but murky emptiness. If Khabu had not been standing a few meters ahead of them, torch held high, Rini would have feared they were about to drive over the edge of some bottomless pit. Khabu raised his hand, signaling them to stop. He walked forward a little way, torch swinging as he looked from side to side, up and down. Then he turned and jogged back. Rini leaned out of the window.
"What is it?"
The little man smiled.
"I think you can drive forward safely. Look."
He held his torch near the ground. Rini stretched so she could look down. By the flickering light, she could see a broad white arrow, and the upside-down words, "Stop."
"It is a parking lot,"
Khabu said. He lifted the torch high.
"See, there are more levels going up."
Rini sat back in her seat. Beyond the headlights, the ramps led up into greater darkness. The lot was vast and absolutely empty.
"I suppose we won't have to worry much about finding a space,"
she said. After hauling in a sufficient amount of firewood, and much against both Jeremiah's and Long Joseph's wishes, Rini connected Sagar Singh through her pad to the control panel on the inside of the lot so that he could close the great door. If someone should happen to discover them, she wanted every bit of protection the government's bomb-proof defenses could provide. "I'm going to download the instructions for opening it again to your pad's memory right now," Singh said, "because as soon as that door closes, you're going to lose me. If that's a hardened military site, an ordinary car phone connection isn't going to pass even a whisper out of there."
"There's a locked elevator with a different kind of code box on it,"
she told the old hacker.
"I think it goes down to the rest of the installation. Can you get that open, too?"
"Not tonight. Jesus, let me get some rest, will you? It's not like I don't have anything else to do but play electronic butler for you lot."
She thanked him, then said goodbye to Martine as well, promising to open the door to make contact in 12 hours. Singh lowered the great slab. As it ground down, his beaky face on the screen dissolved into a flurry of electronic snow. Rini and her friends were cut off. Khabu had a large fire burning, and he and Jeremiah were preparing some of the food they had picked up in the morning, making a stew of inexpensive vat-grown beef and vegetables. Torch in hand, Long Joseph was wandering around the more distant parts of the huge underground lot, which made Rini nervous.
"Just watch out for loose concrete or unmarked stairwells or things like that," she called to him.
He turned and gave her a look she could not quite make out by firelight, but which she assumed was disgusted. The shadowed ceiling was so high and the lot so broad that he seemed to stand far away across a flat desert. For a moment her perspective flipped, and instead of inside they were outside, so completely outside that there were no walls anywhere. The sensation was dizzying. She had to put her hands down on the cool concrete to steady herself.
"This is a good fire,"
Khabu declared. The others, used to a larger selection of amenities, stared at him glumly. The meal had been satisfactory, and for a while Rini had been able to ignore their situation and almost enjoy herself, as if they were simply camping, but that had not lasted long. Habu studied his companion's expressions.
"I think it would be a good time to tell a story," he said suddenly. "I know one that seems appropriate."
Rini broke the subsequent silence.
"Please tell it."
"It is a story of despair and what overcomes it. I think it is a good story to tell on this night, when friends are together around a fire."
He flashed his eye-wrinkling smile.
"First, though, you must know a little bit about my people. I have told Rini stories already, about old Grandfather Mantis and others of the early race. The stories are of long ago, of a time when all animals were people, and Grandfather Mantis himself still walked the earth. But this is one story that is not about him. The men of my people are hunters, or were, since there are almost none left to live in the old way. My father himself was a hunter, a desert bushman, and it was his pursuit of an eland that led him out of the land he knew to my mother. I have told Rini that story, and I will not tell it again tonight. But when the men of my people went out to hunt, often they had to travel far from their women and children to find game. The greatest hunters of all, though, are the stars up in the sky. My people watched them crossing the sky at night, and knew that the bushmen were not the only ones who must travel long and far through difficult places. And the mightiest of all those great hunters is the one that you call the Morning Star, but we call the Heart of Dawn. He is the most tireless tracker in all the world, and his spear flies farther and more swiftly than any other. Back in the ancient days, the Heart of Dawn wished to take a wife. All the people of the early race brought their daughters in hopes that the greatest hunter of all would pick one for his bride. Elephant and python, springbuck and long-nosed mouse, all danced before him, but none spoke to his heart. Of the cats, the lioness was too large. The she-leopard covered with blotches, he solemnly dismissed them all, one at a time, until his eyes fell upon the lynx. She was like a flame to him, with her bright coat and her ears like the glimmering tongues of fire. He felt that she, of all those who had passed before him, was the one that he should marry. When her father agreed to Heart of Dawn's request, as of course he did, there was a feast and dancing and singing. All the people of the early race came. There was some jealousy among those whose daughters were not chosen, but food and music helped to ease that evil in most hearts. The only one who did not join in the celebration was Hyena, from whose daughter the Heart of Dawn had turned away. Hyena was proud, and so was his daughter. They felt themselves to be insulted. Once they were married, Heart of Dawn came to love his lynx more and more. She conceived a child, and soon a son was born to them. In his joy with his new wife, the great hunter brought her back fine things from his journeys in the sky. Earrings, bracelets for her arms and ankles, and a beautiful cape made of hide, and she wore them with happiness, since she was a proper married woman, and so did not leave her fire at night while her husband was away hunting across the sky. Her young sister came to visit with her. Together they spoke and laughed and played with Lynx's baby son while they awaited Heart of Dawn's return. But Hyena and his daughter still felt anger sour in their stomachs, and so old Hyena, who was cunning beyond almost any other, sent his daughter in secret to the camp of Lynx and Heart of Dawn. There was a food, ant eggs, that Lynx enjoyed more than any other. If she had any fault, it was that she was a little greedy, since before she had married Heart of Dawn, she had often been hungry, and always when she found the sweet white eggs, which looked like grains of rice, she would eat them all. Knowing this, Hyena's daughter gathered a pile of ant eggs to leave where Lynx would find them. But first she took her own musk, the perspiration from her armpit, and mixed it with them. Then Hyena's daughter left the eggs and hid herself. Lynx and her sister were foraging for food when Lynx came upon the pile of ant eggs. "Oh," she cried, "here is a good thing. Here is a good thing." But her sister was suspicious and said, "There is something foul-smelling about this food. I do not think it is good to eat." But Lynx was too excited. "I must eat them," she said, picking up all the ant eggs, "because the time might be long until I find such a thing again." Lynx's sister, though, would not eat any of the eggs, because the smell of Hyena's daughter's musk was troubling to her. When they arrived back at camp, Lynx began to feel a pain in her belly, and her head grew hot, as though she leaned too near a fire. She could not sleep that night or the next. Her sister scolded her for being greedy, and brought their mother to help. But the old woman could do nothing, and Lynx became sicker and sicker. She pushed away her young son. She cried and vomited, and her eyes rolled up in her head. One by one, her beautiful ornaments began to fall away and drop to the ground. First her earrings, then her arm bracelets and her ankle bracelets, her cape of hide, even the leather thongs of her sandals, until she lay naked and weeping. At that moment, Lynx stood up and ran away into the darkness. Lynx's mother was so terrified that she ran back to her own camp to tell her husband that their daughter was dying. But her sister followed Lynx where she fled. When the camp was empty, Hyena's daughter entered into it from the dark night beyond the firelight. First, she put on Lynx's fallen earrings. Then she picked up and donned her ostrich shell bracelets and her cape of hide, even her sandals. When she had done this, Hyena's daughter sat down beside the fire and laughed, saying, "Now I am Heart of Dawn's wife, as I should have been." Lynx fled into the bush, and her sister followed her. In her unhappiness, Lynx ran until she came to a place of reeds and water, and there she sat, weeping and crying out. Her sister came to her and called, "Why do you not come back to your home? What if your husband returns and you are not beside the fire? Will he not fear for you?" But Lynx only went farther back into the reeds, until she was standing knee-deep in the water, and said, "I feel the spirit of the hyena in me. I am lonely and afraid, and the darkness has fallen on me. Because of what happened to Lynx, my people still say the time of the hyena is upon someone when that person's spirit is ill." Lynx's sister held forth Lynx's son and said, "Your baby wants to suckle. Look, he is hungry. You must give him your breast." And for a little while, Lynx was persuaded to come and suckle her baby. But then she put him down and fled back into the water again, deeper this time, so that it reached her waist. Each time her sister persuaded her to come out and nurse her baby, Lynx held her son for a shorter time, and each time she retreated to the waters, she went in deeper, until the water was almost to her mouth. At last, Lynx's sister went away in sorrow, taking the baby boy back to the fireside to be warmed. For it was cold beneath the night sky, and colder where the reeds grew. But when she approached the camp, she saw a person with glowing eyes sitting at the fire, dressed in all of Lynx's clothes and ornaments. "Ah," said this person, "there is my baby son. Why have you stolen him? Give him to me now." For a moment, Lynx's sister was amazed, thinking that it was her sister returned from the reeds and the water. But then she smelled the stink of hyena and was fearful. She held the boy tightly in her arms and ran away from the fire, while Hyena's daughter howled after her, "Bring back my child! I am the wife of Heart of Dawn!" Lynx's sister knew then what had happened, and knew that by the time her brother-in-law returned from his long journey across the sky, it would be too late to save her sister. She went to a high place and lifted her head to the dark night, and began to sing, "Heart of Dawn, hear me, hear me. Heart of Dawn, come back from your hunt. Your wife is ill, your child is hungry. Heart of Dawn, this is a bad time." She sang this over and over, louder and louder, until at last the great hunter heard her. He came rushing back across the sky, eyes flashing, until he stood before Lynx's sister. She told him everything that had happened, and he grew furiously angry. He ran to his camp. When he got there, Hyena's daughter stood up, her stolen earrings and bracelets tinkling. She tried to make her deep, growling voice sweet like Lynx's, as she said to him, "Husband, you have returned. And what have you brought back for your wife? Have you brought game? Have you brought gifts?"
"Only one gift have I brought you, and this is it," said Heart of Dawn, flinging his spear. The she-hyena shrieked and sprang away, and the spear missed her. the only time Heart of Dawn ever missed his cast, for the hyena magic is old and very strong, but as she dodged it, she stepped into the fire, and the coals burnt her legs, which made her shriek even louder. She cast aside Lynx's stolen belongings and ran away as swiftly as she could, limping from the pain of her burns. And if you see a hyena today, you will see that he walks as though his feet are tender, as do all the offspring of Hyena's daughter, and that his legs are still blackened from Heart of Dawn's fire. And so when the hunter had driven the interloper away, he went to the place of waters and brought his wife out again, and gave her back her ornaments and clothing, and placed her young son in her arms once more. Then, with Lynx's sister beside them, they returned to their camp. And now, when the morning star we call Heart of Dawn returns from his hunting, he always comes swiftly, and even the dark night runs from him. When he appears, you can see night flee along the horizon, the red dust rising up from its heels. And that is the end of my story.
All was silent after the small man had finished. Jeremiah slowly nodded his head, as though he had heard something confirmed that he had long believed. Long Joseph was nodding too, but for a different reason. He had dozed off.
"That was wonderful,"
Rini said at last. Habu's tale had seemed oddly vivid, yet familiar too, as though she had heard parts of it before, although she knew she had not.
"That was... it reminded me of so many things.
I am glad you heard it. I hope you will remember it when you are unhappy. We all must pray for the kindness of others to give us strength."
For a moment, the glow of the fire seemed to fill the room, pushing the shadows back. Rini allowed herself the luxury of a little hope. She stared down over a broad, night-blotted desert from above. Whether she sat in the branches of a tree or on the steps of a hillside, she could not tell. People perched on every side of her, although she could barely see them.
"I'm glad you've come to stay in my house,"
said Susan Von Blake from the darkness beside her.
"It's too high in the air, of course. Sometimes I worry that everyone will fall off,
but I can't stay."
Rini was afraid of hurting Susan's feelings, but she knew it had to be said.
"I have to go and take Stephen his school things. Papa will be angry if I don't."
She felt a dry, bony hand close on her wrist.
"Oh, but you can't leave. He is out there, you know."
"He is?"
Rini felt a mounting agitation.
"But I have to go across. I have to take Stephen his books for school."
The idea of her brother waiting for her, alone and crying, vied with the dreadful import of the doctor's words. She only vaguely knew what or who Susan meant, but she knew what it signified was bad.
"Of course he is. He smells us."
The grip on Meany's arm tightened.
"He hates us because we're up here, and because we're warm when he's so cold."
Even as the doctor spoke, Rini felt something, a spike of chill wind coming in off the desert. The other near-invisible shapes felt it too, and there was a rush of frightened whispering.
"But I can't stay here. Stephen is out there, on the other side."
"But you can't go down there, either." The doctor's voice seemed different now, and so did her smell.
"He is waiting. I told you, he's always waiting, because he's always on the outside."
It was not the doctor sitting beside her in the darkness. It was her mother. Rini recognized her voice and the scent of the lemony perfume she had liked to wear.
"Mama?"
There was no reply, but she could feel her mother's warmth only a few inches away. As Rini began to speak again, she sensed something new, something that froze her with fear. Something was out there, prowling in the darkness beneath them, snuffling for something to devour.
"Silence!"
her mother hissed.
"He's very close, child."
A stink rose toward them, a strange, chilly smell of dead things and old, once burnt things and musty, deserted places. With the smell came a feeling, as strong and clear to Rini's senses as the stench, a tangible wave of wretched evil, of jealousy and gnawing hatred and misery, and utter, utter loneliness, the emanation from something that had been consigned to darkness since before time itself began, and which knew nothing of the light except that it hated it.
Rini suddenly did not ever want to leave that high place.
"Mama," she began, "I need to—"
Suddenly her feet slipped out from beneath her, and she was plummeting helplessly into blackness, falling, falling, and the wretched, hateful, powerful thing below was opening its great, foul jaws to catch her. Rini sat up gasping, her blood pounding in her ears. For a long moment she did not know where she was. When she remembered, it was not much better. Exiled. Fugitive. Driven into a strange and unknown land. The last sensation of the dream, of falling toward a waiting evil, had not entirely left her. She felt sickened, and her skin was stippled with goose flesh.
"The time of the hyena,"
she thought, tempted toward despair.
"Like Habu said, and it's really here."
It was hard even to lie back down, but she forced herself. The regular breathing of the others, which floated and echoed in the great darkness above her, was her only link to the light.
"You mean we could have had the electricity on last night?"
Long Joseph thrust his hands in his pockets and leaned forward.
"Instead of sitting around some fire?"
"The power is on, yes."
Rini was frustrated at having to explain again.
"It's power for the building to do self-maintenance, and for the security systems. But that doesn't mean we should use any more than we have to."
"I hurt my foot trying to find a toilet in the dark. I could have fallen down some hole and broke my neck."
"Look, Papa,"
she began, then stopped. Why did she keep fighting the same battles? She turned and walked across the wide cement floor toward the elevators.
"How is it going?"
she asked. Habu looked up.
"Mr. Singh is still working."
6 hours, said Jeremiah. "We aren't ever going to get this thing open. I didn't expect to spend the rest of my life in a bloody parking garage."
Singh's voice buzzed from the pad, compressed to a fraction of the usual bandwidth.
"Jesus, all you lot do is complain. Just be grateful that this place has been shut down or decommissioned or whatever the hell you call it. It could have been a damn sight harder to get in than it was. Not to mention the lack of armed guards, which certainly would have added to the difficulty."
He sounded more hurt than angry, perhaps at having his abilities questioned.
"I'll get it eventually, but these are the original palm print readers. Those are quite a bit tougher to crack than a simple code system."
"I know," Rini said, "and we're grateful. It's been difficult, that's all. The last few days have been stressful."
"Stressful?"
The old man's voice took on an offended tone.
"You should try to break into the world's most carefully guarded network, with a nurse coming in every few minutes to check your bedpan, or insist you finish your rice pudding. And there aren't any locks on the doors in the goddamn place, so I've got senile old bastards pushing in on me all the time because they think it's their own room. Not to mention I have gastric pains like you wouldn't believe from the medication I'm on. And meanwhile I'm just trying to get you past the security system of a top-secret military base. I'll tell you about stressful."
Thoroughly rebuked, Rini walked away. Her head hurt, and she was out of pain blockers. She lit a cigarette, although she didn't really want one.
"No one is happy today,"
Habu said quietly. Rini jumped. She hadn't heard him approach.
"What about you? You seem happy enough."
Habu's look was tinged with sad amusement. Rini felt a tug of guilt at the sharpness of her response.
"Of course I am not happy, Rini. I am unhappy because of what has happened to you and your family. I am unhappy because I cannot go forward with the thing I wish to do most in all the world. And I am fearful that we have discovered something truly dangerous, as I have told you, and that it is beyond our powers to do anything about it. But being angry will not help us, at least not now."
He smiled a little, and his eyes crinkled at the corners.
"Perhaps later, when things are better, I will be angry."
She was again grateful for his calm good nature, but with that gratitude came a small mote of resentment. His even disposition made her feel she was being forgiven time after time, and she did not like being forgiven for anything.
"When things are better? Are you sure that things will be better?"
He shrugged.
"It is a matter of words. In my birth language, there are more ifs than whens, but I must make a choice every time I speak a sentence in English. I try to choose the happier way of saying things, so that my own words will not weigh me down like stones. Does that make sense?"
"I think so."
"Rini!"
Jeremiah sounded alarmed. She turned in time to see the light flash above one of the elevators. A moment later, the door slid open.
It's like being that explorer,
Rini thought, as the elevator stopped noiselessly on the first level down.
The one who discovered the Pharaoh's lost tomb.
Her next thought, a disconcerting memory of a curse that had supposedly killed the discoverer, was interrupted but not banished by the hiss of the opening door. It had only been a suite of offices, and was now empty of furniture except for a large conference table and some big file cabinets whose drawers gaped. Fileless, Rini's heart sank. The place's bare-boned condition did not bode well. She and the others walked through all the rooms on the floor, making certain there was nothing more useful in any of them, then got back into the elevator. Three more levels of similarly stripped offices did not improve her state of mind. There were enough large pieces of furniture to suggest that the decommissioning had ground to a halt at some point, but the empty Warrens contained nothing of real value. There were a few eerie reminders that this place had once been a living environment, a couple of calendars almost 2 decades old still hanging on walls, antique announcements about this or that function or rules change yellowed on bulletin boards, even a photo taped to an office window of a woman and children, all dressed in tribal costumes as though for some ceremony, but they only made the place seem more deserted, more dead. The floor below was full of stainless steel counters that made Rini think uncomfortably of a pathologist's examining room, until she realized that this had been the kitchen. A large, empty room stacked high with folding tables confirmed the guess. The next 2 floors contained cubicles she guessed had been dormitories, empty now like the cells of a long-unused beehive.
"People lived here?"
Jeremiah asked.
"Some probably did."
Rini picked up her pad and sent the elevator down again.
"Or they may have just had the facilities ready in case of war, but never used them. Martine said this place was some kind of special Air Force installation."
"This is the last floor,"
her father observed, somewhat needlessly, since the buttons on the elevator wall were easy to count.
"And there isn't anything above where we came in but 2 more floors of parking lot, like I told you. I looked."
He sounded almost cheerful. Rini caught Khabu's eye. The little man's expression did not change, but he held her gaze as if to send her strength.
"He doesn't think there's anything here either."
She felt a sense of unreality wash over her. Or maybe it was reality. What had they expected, after all?
A complete, functioning, high-tech military base left for them like some magical castle under a spell?
The elevator door pulled back. Rini didn't even need to look. And her father's words held no surprises.
"Just some more offices. Looks like some kind of big meeting room over there."
She took a breath.
"Let's walk through them anyway. It can't hurt." Feeling more and more as if she were caught in a particularly tiresome and depressing dream, she led them out into the sectioned space.
She stood staring as the others wandered off in separate directions. This first room had been stripped to the walls, everything taken except the ugly, institutional beige carpet. In her miserable state of mind, she could not help thinking about how hellish it must have been to work in this windowless place, breathing canned air, knowing you were sunk beneath 1,000,000 tons of stone. She turned in disgust to head back to the elevator, too flatly miserable even to think about what they might do next.
"There is another elevator!"
Khabu called. It took a moment to sink in.
"What?
Another elevator! Here, in the far corner!"
Rini and the others made their way through the labyrinth, then stood and gaped at the very ordinary-looking elevator as though it were a landed UFO.
"Is it another one down from the entrance?"
Rini asked, not willing to reach out for hope again.
"There weren't any on this wall, girl,"
said Long Joseph.
"He's right."
Jeremiah reached out and carefully touched the door. Rini ran back to unhook her pad from the other elevator. There were no buttons inside the matte gray box, and at first the door would not even close again. She rehooked the pad to the inside hand reader and keyed in Singh's code sequence. A moment later, the doors shut. The car traveled down for a surprisingly long time. Then the doors pinged open.
"Oh, my lord," said Jeremiah. "Look at this place."
Rini blinked. It was the Pharaoh's tomb. Long Joseph suddenly laughed.
"I see it. They built this damn place first. Then they built the rest of the damn thing on top of it. They couldn't get this stuff out of here without blowing up the damned mountain.
Habu had already stepped forward. Rini followed him. The ceiling was 5 times as high as that of the garage. A great vault of natural stone hung with scores of boxy light fixtures, each the size of a double bed. These were slowly smoldering into a yellowish half-light, as though someone had turned them on to honor the visitors. The walls were ringed with several tiers of offices, which appeared to have been cut into the living rock, fenced with catwalks. Rini and the others stood on the third up from the bottom of the cavern, looking down to the floor at least 12 meters below. Banks of equipment, many covered with plastic sheets, were arrayed all around the floor, although there were gaps where things were obviously missing. Cables hung like Titan cobwebs from a grid of troughs. And at the center of the room, massive and strange as the sarcophagi of dead god kings, lay 12 huge ceramic coffins. Chapter 28. A Visit to Uncle. Netfeed News.
UN fears new Bukavu strain.
Visual. Ghanaian Bukavu victims stacked outside Accra Hospital. VO.
UN Med field workers are reporting a possible new variant of the Bukavu virus. The new strain, already unofficially called Bukavu 5, has a longer dormancy period, which enables carriers to spread the disease more widely than those infected with Bukavu 4, which kills in 2 to 3 days.
Visual, UN Med Chief Officer Ingenia at news conference. Ingenia,
these viruses are mutating very swiftly. We are fighting a series of epidemiological brush fires across Africa and the Indian subcontinent. So far, we have managed to keep these conflagrations under control. But without better resources, a larger breakout seems inevitable.
A man was being buried alive out in the courtyard, thumping frantically on the inside of his casket as dirt rained down on the lid. In the upper reaches of the vaulted ceiling, a huge, shaggy, spider-like creature was wrapping another customer in webbing that, judging by the shrieks of the victim, burned like acid. It was all very, very boring. Orlando thought even the house skeletons looked a little slow and tired. As he watched, the small squadron performing maneuvers on his tabletop failed in their attempt to shift the virtual sugar bowl. It rolled over, crushing 12 of them into tiny, simulated bone fragments. Orlando didn't even smile. Fredericks wasn't here. None of the other Last Chance Saloon regulars could remember seeing him since the last time the two of them had been in together. Orlando moved on. His friend wasn't in any of the other Terminal Row establishments either, although someone in the Living End said she thought she'd seen him recently. But since this particular witness was nicknamed Vaporhead, Orlando didn't put much store in the sighting. He was more than a little worried. He had left several messages over the last week, directly to Frederick's account and with mutual friends, but Frederick's hadn't responded to any of them, or even picked any of them up. Orlando had assumed that Frederick's, like himself, had been tumbled out of Treehouse at the end of their sojourn there and back into his normal life, that his friend was just being quiet because he was mad at Orlando for dragging him into this latest obsession. Now he was beginning to wonder if something more serious might be going on. Orlando shifted again, this time to the Middle Country. But instead of the Garot and Dirk in ancient Madrikor's Thieves' Quarter, his usual entry point for new adventures, he found himself on a vast stone staircase facing a massive pair of wooden doors decorated with a pair of Titan scales. Temple of the Table of Judgment, he thought. Wow, that was a quick deliberation. The doors opened, and the torch flames leaped in the wall sconces. Orlando, now wearing his familiar Thargor sim, walked forward. Despite his current disaffection, it was hard not to respond to the gravity of the occasion. The high-ceilinged room was all in shadow but for a single column of light that angled down from the stained-glass window. The window was also decorated with the Table of Judgment crest, and the light spilling through it perfectly illuminated the masked and robed figures sitting in a circle below. Even the stone walls looked convincingly old and impressive, smoothed by the passage of centuries. Despite having seen it all before, Orlando found himself admiring all the work that had gone into it. That was the reason he had always played the Middle Country exclusively. the people who built and owned it were gamers and artists, not slave labor hired by a corporation. They wanted it right because they wanted to hang out in it themselves. One of the figures rose and spoke in a firm, clear voice.
Thargor, your appeal has been considered. We are all aware of your history and have admired your feats of daring. We also know you to be a competitor who does not lightly ask for the table's intervention.
There was a pause. All of the faces were turned toward him, unreadable beneath the cloth masks.
However, we cannot find merit in your appeal. Thargor, your death is ruled lawful.
Can I get access to the records you used in your deliberation? Orlando asked, but the masked figure did not even pause. After a moment, Orlando realized that the entire judgment was recorded.
We are sure that with your skills, you will return to the Middle Country in another guise, and make a new name famous throughout the land. But those who revere the history of the Middle Country will never forget Thargor. Good luck. You have heard the decision of the Table of Judgment.
The temple vanished before Orlando could say anything. An instant later, he was in the fitting room, the place where new characters purchased attributes and literally built themselves before entering the Middle Country. He stood staring around him, but not really seeing. He felt some pain, but surprisingly little. Thargor was definitely dead. After all the time he had spent being Thargor, it should have meant more than it did.
"Oh, it's you, Gardner," said the attendant priest. "Heard about Thargor getting toasted. Really sorry, but we all gotta go sometime, I guess. What are you going to do now? Another warrior type? Or maybe something different? A wizard?"
Orlando snorted in disgust. "Listen, can you find out if Piflet the thief has been in lately?" The priest shook his head.
"I'm not allowed to do that. Can't you leave him a message?"
"I've tried." Orlando sighed. "Doesn't matter. See you around."
"Huh? Aren't you going to refit yourself? Man, people are out there jockeying for your spot at the top, Gardner. Dieter Cabo's already put out an open challenge to all comers. He just needs a few points to jump into your old place."
With only the smallest twinge of remorse, Orlando left the Middle Country. He looked around his cot with disaffection. It was fine in its way, but it was so young. The trophies in particular, which had meant so much when he acquired them, now seemed faintly embarrassing, and a Simworld window full of dinosaurs. Dinosaurs! They were such a kid thing. Even the MBC window now seemed pathetic, souvenir of an obsession with an idea that only nostalgics and a few wareheads even cared about anymore. Human beings weren't ever going out into space. It was too expensive and too complicated. Taxpayers in a country that had to turn its sports coliseums into tent cities and house its excess prison population on barges weren't going to pay billions of dollars to send a few people to another star system. And the idea of making a nearer planet like Mars habitable was already beginning to fade. And even if everything changed, and humans suddenly decided once more that space was the place, Orlando Gardner would certainly never get there. "Beazle," he said, "come here." His agent squeezed through a crack in the wall, legs flailing, and skittered toward him.
"I'm all ears, boss. Anything on Fredericks?" "Not a whisper. I'm monitoring, but there hasn't been any sign of activity."
Orlando stared at the pyramid of trophy cases and wondered what it would feel like simply to throw them away, to have them cleared right out of his system memory. Experimentally, he hid them. The corner of the virtual room suddenly looked naked.
"Find me his parents' home number. Fredericks in West Virginia. Somewhere in the hills."
Beazle beetled a wobbly single eyebrow.
"You can't narrow it down any? Preliminary says there's more than 200 listings under the name Fredericks in West Virginia."
Orlando sighed.
"I don't know. We never talk about stuff like that. I don't think he has any brothers or sisters. Parents work for the government. I think they have a dog."
He thought hard.
"He must have registered some of this information in the Middle Country when he first signed up." "Doesn't mean it's available to the public," said Beazle darkly. "I'll see what I can find."
He disappeared through a hole in the floor.
"Hey, Beazle!" Orlando shouted. "Bug! Come back!"
The agent crawled out from beneath the virtual couch, dragging his legs in a self-pitying way.
"Yes, boss,"
I live to serve you, boss. What is it now, boss?
Do you think this room is stupid? Beazle sat motionless, looking for all the world like the discarded head of a mop. For a moment, Orlando thought he had gone past the bounds of the agent's gear.
Do you think it's stupid?
Beazle asked at last.
Don't mirror back what I say.
Orlando was exasperated. That was the cheapest kind of artificial life programming trick. When in doubt, answer a question with the same question.
Just tell me, in your opinion, is it stupid or not?
Beazle froze again. Orlando had a sudden pang of worry. What if he had pushed it too hard? It was only software, after all. And why was he asking a piece of gear something like this anyway? If Fredericks were around, he would be telling Orlando just how utterly he scanned.
I don't know what stupid means in this context, boss, said Beazle finally.
Orlando was embarrassed. It was like forcing someone to admit in public that they were illiterate.
Yeah, you're right. Go see if you can find that phone number.
Beazle obligingly dropped out of sight once more. Orlando settled back to think of something to do to occupy the time while Beazle did his work. It was about 4 in the afternoon, which meant he only had a little while until Vivian and Conrad came home and he had to surface. So he couldn't afford to get into anything too complicated, like gaming. Not that he had any particular urge to get involved in any games at present. The Golden City, and the several layers of mystery that surrounded it, had made chasing monsters in the Middle Country seem a bit of a waste of time. He created a screen in the middle of his room and began flicking through net nodes. He browsed for a while in Lambda Mall, but the idea of actually buying anything made him feel depressed, and nothing looked very interesting anyway. He jumped through the entertainment channels, watching a few minutes here and there of various shows and flicks and straight commercial presentations, letting the noises and effects wash over him like water. He scanned some news headlines, but nothing sounded worth watching. At last he vanished the Elcott, went full surround, and wandered into the interactive sections. After specifying view only, he watched almost half an hour's worth of a program on living at the bottom of the sea until he got bored with floating around like a fish while people demonstrated underwater farming, then began to flick through some of the specialized children's entertainment. As the nodes flipped by, a familiar exaggerated smile caught his attention.
"I don't know why they stole my handkerchief," said Uncle Jingle. "All I know is, snot fair."
All the children on the show, the Jingle Jungle crew, laughed and clapped their hands. Uncle Jingle. Orlando, just about to shift again, paused. He dismissed the "Who are you?" query that popped up at the 10-second mark. He was way too old to sign on. And anyway, he didn't particularly want any attention at the present. Still, Orlando continued to watch, fascinated. He hadn't seen Uncle Jingle for years.
Snot fair. Man, the scanny things you watch when you're a little kid.
"Well," continued Uncle, bobbing his tiny head, "whatever the reason, I'm going to track that handkerchief down. And when I find it, I think I'm going to teach Pantalona and old Mr. Daddy Whiner a lesson. Who wants to help me?"
Several of the participating kids, promoted out of the daily audience of millions by some arcane selection process, jumped up and down and shouted. Orlando stared, fascinated. He had forgotten how weird Uncle Jingle was, with his huge toothy smile and tiny black button eyes. He looked like a two-legged shark or something.
"Let's sing a song, okay?" said the host. "That'll make the trip go faster. If you don't know the words, touch my hand."
Orlando did not touch Uncle's hand, and was thus spared the additional indignity of local language subtitles, but was still forced to listen to dozens of happy childish voices singing about the sins of Jingle's arch-nemesis, Pantalona.
"She simply loves to be unfair, that vixen with the corkscrew hair. She doesn't wash her underwear, Pantalona Peach Pit. She tosses stones at little birds. She loves to shout out naughty words. She even eats the doggies' food. Pantalona Peach Pit."
Orlando grimaced. He decided that, after a childhood spent in the opposite camp, his sympathies were beginning to shift to Pantalona, the red-headed renegade.
Uncle Jingle and his entourage were now dancing and singing down the street past the graffiti wall, headed for a rendezvous with the lost handkerchief and vengeance against Uncle's enemies. Orlando, nostalgia more than satisfied, was just about to shift to something else when a slogan on the simulated wall caught his attention. Painted letters that read, "Wicked Tribe, Z-Ruling Tribe." Orlando leaned forward. He had thought that with his one indigo favor called in, he was out of connections to Treehouse, and through Treehouse to the mystery of the Griffin and whatever light that might shed on the radiant, magical city. But here, of all places, was a familiar name, a name that, properly followed, might get him back into Treehouse. It had been a long time since he had been a regular fan of Uncle Jingle's Jungle, and he had forgotten more than simply why he had liked it in the first place. There was some routine for posting a message, but he was damned if he could remember it. Instead, he pointed at Bob the Ball, the chuckling sphere that always bounced along through the air just behind Uncle Jingle. After he had pointed long enough for it to register as more than a casual gesture, Bob the Ball appeared to burst open, although none of the other viewers would see that unless they, too, were requesting help, disgorging a number of pictographs designed to help Uncle Jingle's young audience make choices. Orlando found the one that concerned making new friends and entered his message. "Looking for Wicked Tribe." He hesitated for a moment, then left a dead drop address for contacts. There was no immediate answer, but he decided to stay connected for a while just in case. "Oh, look!" Uncle Jingle did a little dance of pleasure, his long tuxedo coat flapping. "Look who's been waiting for us at the Bridge of Sighs! It's the Mingle Pig! But oh, look, the Mingle Pig is big, big, big!" The entire company of the Jingle Jungle crew, along with an invisible worldwide audience, turned to look. Already as large as a house, and growing larger by the second, was the uncle's friend and erstwhile pet, the Mingle Pig, an amorphous aggregation of dozens of porcine legs, trotters, snouts, eyes, and curly pink tails. Orlando felt a moment of recognition, as he saw for the first time in its wriggling outline the roots of his own Beelzebub design. But where he had once found the Mingle Pig thrillingly funny, he now found its centerless squirming unpleasant.
"Never spend too long on the Bridge of Sighs," declared Uncle Jingle, as seriously as if he were explaining the second law of thermodynamics. "You'll get real big, or you'll get real small. And what's happened to Mingle Pig?"
"He's big!"
shouted the Jingle Jungle crew, seemingly unfazed by the anemone-like mass that now loomed over them like a mountain.
"We have to help him get small again."
Uncle looked around, his licorice-drop eyes wide.
"Who can think of something to help him?"
"Stick a pin in him. Call Zoomer's Iz. Tell him to stop it. Make him go to the other end of the bridge,"
suggested one of the children at last, a little girl by the sound of her, whose sim was a toy panda. Uncle nodded happily.
"I think that's a very good idea."
Uncle needed a split second to call up the name.
"Michiko? Come on! If we all shout it at once, maybe he'll hear us. But we have to shout loud, because his ears are very high up now."
All the children began to screech. The Mingle Pig, like a particularly grotesque parade float losing its air, flattened itself toward the ground, listening. At the children's direction, it moved a little way back along the bridge, but then stopped, confused. The crew began to scream even more shrilly. The din became excruciatingly painful. Wicked Tribe or not, Orlando had reached his limit. He entered his message so that it would continue to appear on the Making New Friends band, then exited Uncle Jingle's Jungle.
"Orlando!" Someone was shaking him. "Orlando!"
He opened his eyes. Vivian's face was very close, full of concern and irritation, a combination Orlando was used to seeing. "I'm okay. I was just watching a show."
"How can you not hear me? I don't like that at all."
He shrugged. "I was just concentrating, and I had it up pretty loud. It was this really interesting thing about farming in the ocean. That ought to hold her," he figured. Vivian approved of educational programs. He didn't want to tell her that, since he hadn't set the T-jack to keep a line open for normal external input,
that is, stuff going from his actual ear to his auditory nerve, he hadn't heard her, any more than he would have if she'd been shouting his name in Hawaii. She stared, dissatisfied, although she was clearly not sure why.
How are you feeling?
Sore? It was true. His joints had already been aching, and Vivian's energetic wake-up hadn't helped any. The pain blocker must have worn off. Vivian pulled a pair of dermals from the drawer beside the bed, one for pain, the other his evening anti-inflammatory fix. He tried to put them on, but his fingers ached and he fumbled them. Vivian frowned and took them from him, applying them with practiced skill to his bony arms.
"What were you doing plowing the bottom of the sea yourself? No wonder you're hurting, thrashing around on that stupid net."
He shook his head. "You know I can turn off my own muscle reactions when I'm online, Vivian. That's the great thing about the plug-in interfaces."
"For the fortune they cost, they'd better do something."
She paused. Their conversation seemed to have moved through its usual arc, and now Orlando expected her either to shake her head and leave, or seize the chance to offer a few more dire predictions. Instead, she sat herself on the edge of the bed, careful not to put weight on his legs or feet.
"Orlando, are you scared?"
"Do you mean right now, or ever?"
"Either. I mean..."
She looked away, then determinedly returned her gaze to him. He was struck for the first time in a while by how pretty she was. There were lines on her forehead and at the corners of her eyes and mouth, but she still had a firm jaw and her very clear blue eyes. In the dim afternoon light, with day fast fading, she looked no different from the woman who had held him when he was still young enough to be held.
"I mean, it isn't fair, Orlando. It's not. Your illness shouldn't happen to the worst person in the world, and you're not that at all. You may drive me crazy sometimes, but you're smart and sweet and very brave. Your father and I love you a lot."
He opened his mouth, but no sounds came.
"I wish there was something else I could tell you besides be brave. I wish I could be brave for you. Oh, God, I wish I could."
She blinked, then kept her eyes closed for a long moment, one hand stretched out to rest lightly on his chest.
"You know that, don't you?"
He swallowed and nodded. This was embarrassing and painful, but in a way it also felt good. Orlando didn't know which was worse. "I love you too, Vivian," he said at last. "Conrad too." She looked at him. Her smile was crooked.
"We know that being on the net means a lot to you, that you have friends there, and
something like a real life."
"Yes. But we miss you, honey. We want to see as much of you as we can."
"While I'm still around," he finished for her. She flinched as though he had shouted.
"That's part of it,"
she said finally. Orlando felt her then in a way he hadn't for some time, saw the strain she was under, the fears that his condition brought. In a way, he was being cruel, spending so much time in a world that to her was invisible and unreachable. But now, more than ever, he had to be there. He considered telling her about the city, but could not imagine a way he could say it that wouldn't make it sound stupid, like a sick kid's impossible daydream. After all, he couldn't really convince himself it was anything other than that. He and Vivian and Conrad already walked a very difficult line with pity. He didn't want to do anything that would make things more difficult for everyone. "I know, Vivian.
Maybe we could put aside some time every day to talk, just like we're talking now."
Her face was so full of poorly hidden hope that he could barely watch.
"A little time. You can tell me about the net, all the things you've seen."
He sighed, but kept it nearly silent. He was still waiting for the pain blocker to take effect, and it was hard to be patient even with a person you loved.
Loved?
That was a strange thought. He did love Vivian, though, and even Conrad, although sightings of his father sometimes seemed as rare as those of other fabled monsters like Nessie or Sasquatch.
"Hey, boss," said Beazle into his ear, "I think I got something for you."
Orlando pushed himself a little more upright, ignoring the throbbing of his joints, and put on a tired smile. "Okay, Vivian, it's a deal, but not right now, okay? I'm feeling kind of sleepy." He disliked himself more than he usually did for lying, but in a funny way it was her own fault. She had reminded him how little time he truly had.
"Fine, honey. You just lie down again, then. Do you want something to drink?"
"No, thanks." He slid back down and closed his eyes, then listened to her close the door. What do you have?
I got a phone number, for one thing.
Beazle made the clicking noise he used to indicate self-satisfaction.
But first, I think you got a call coming in. Something named Lolo.
Orlando shut his eyes, but this time left his external auditory channels open. He flicked to his cot and opened a screen. His caller was a lizard with a mouth full of fangs and an exaggerated artifact-strewn topknot of goggle boy hair. At the last moment, Orlando remembered to turn up his own volume so he could whisper. He didn't want to bring Vivian back into the room to check on him. "You're Lolo?"
"Maybe,"
the lizard said. The voice was altered with all kinds of irritating noise, hums and scrapes and trendy distortion.
"Why, you beep wicked tribe?"
Orlando's heart quickened. He hadn't expected to hear anything back on his query so soon. "Are you one of them?" He didn't remember a Lolo, but there had been quite a few monkeys. The lizard stared at him balefully.
"Flyin' now,"
it said. "Wait, don't go. I met the wicked tribe in Treehouse. I looked like this." He flashed an image of his Thargor sim across. "If you weren't there, you can ask the rest of them. Ask..." He racked his brain, struggling to remember. "Ask Zuni. Yeah. And I think there was someone named Caspar, too."
"Caspar?"
The lizard tilted his head.
"Caspar, he ziz near me. Zuni, chop it. She far, far crash. But still no gimme. Why, you beep wickedness?"
It was hard to tell whether English was Lolo's second language, or the reptile-wearing tribesperson was simply so sunk in kid-speak as to be almost unintelligible, even to Orlando. He guessed it might be some of both, and guessed also that Lolo was younger than it wanted people to think. "Look, I need to talk to the wicked tribe. I'm involved in a special operation, and I need their help."
"Help? Cred time, maybe? Candy, what's the charge?"
"It's a secret, I told you. I can only talk about it at a meeting of the wicked tribe, with everyone sworn to secrecy." Lolo considered this.
"You funny, funny man?"
it asked at last.
"Baby bouncer? Skin stim? Sin sim?"
"No, no. It's a secret mission. You understand that? Very important. Very secret." The tiny eyes got even tinier as Lolo thought some more.
"Zun! Laskum! Flyin' now!"
The contact was ended. "Yeah. Zang, that's something gone right for once." He summoned Beazle. "You said you found a phone number for Fredericks?"
"Only one that makes sense. These government people, they don't want anyone finding out where they live, you know. They buy those data eaters. Send them out to chew up anything tagged to their names that's floating around the net."
"So how did you find it?"
"Well, I'm not sure I did, but I think it's right. Minor child named Sam, couple other hits as well. Thing about data eaters, they leave holes. And sometimes the holes tell you as much as the things that used to be there."
Orlando laughed.
"You're pretty smart for an imaginary friend." "I'm good gear, boss. Call it for me."
The number beeped several times. Then the house system on the other end, having decided that Orlando's account number didn't fit the first-level profile for a nuisance call, passed him through to the message center. Orlando indicated his desire to talk with a living human being.
"Hello?"
It was a woman's voice, tinged with a slight southern accent. "Hello, is this the Fredericks residence?"
"Yes, it is. Can I help you?"
"I'd like to speak to Sam, please."
"Oh, Sam's not here right now. Who's calling?"
"Orlando Gardner. I'm a friend."
"I haven't met you, have I? Or at least your name isn't familiar. But then..."
The woman paused. For a moment she went away.
"Sorry, it's a bit confusing here," she said when she came back. "The maid has just dropped something. What did you say your name was? Rolando? I'll tell Sam you called when she gets back from soccer.
Chiz. I mean, thanks." It took an instant to register. "She? Just a second, ma'am. I think..." But the woman had clicked off. "Beazle, was that the only number you had that matched? Because that's not the one."
"Sorry, boss. Go ahead and kick me. Closest to fitting the profile. I'll try again, but I can't promise anything."
2 hours later, Orlando started up from a half-sleep. The lights in his room were dim, his IV throwing a gallows shadow onto the wall beside him. He turned down the Medea's Kids record that was playing softly on his auditory shunt. A troubling thought had lodged itself in his mind, and he could not make it go away. "Beazle, get me that number again."
He made his way back through the screening system. After a short delay, the same woman's voice came on. "This is the person who called before. Is Sam back yet?"
"Oh, yes. I forgot to tell her you called. I'll just see."
There was another wait, but this one seemed painfully long, because Orlando didn't know what he was waiting for.
"Yes?"
Just from that one word, he knew. Because it wasn't processed to sound masculine, it was higher than he was used to. But he knew that voice. "Fredericks?" The silence was complete. Orlando waited it out.
"Gardner, is that you?"
Orlando felt something like rage. But it was an emotion as confusing as it was painful.
"You bastard," he said at last. "Why didn't you tell me?" "I'm sorry."
Frederick's new voice was faint.
"But it's not like you think."
"What's to think? I thought you were my friend. I thought you were my male friend. Was it funny, listening to me talk about girls? Letting me make a total scan box out of myself?" He suddenly remembered one now cringeworthy occasion where he had talked about how he would put together his ideal female from the different body parts of famous net stars.
I just...
He was suddenly unable to say more.
"But it's not like you think. Not exactly. I mean, it wasn't supposed to..."
Fredericks didn't say anything for a moment. When the familiar but unfamiliar girl's voice spoke again, it was flat and sorrowful.
"How did you get this number?"
"Tracked it down. I was looking for you because I was worried about you, Fredericks. Or should I call you Samantha?" He put as much scorn into it as he could summon.
It's Salome, actually. Sam was a joke of my dad's when I was little, but..."
"Why didn't you tell me? I mean, it's one thing when you're just messing around on the net, but we were friends, man." He laughed bitterly.
"Man." "That was it. See, by the time we were friends, I didn't know how to just tell you. I was afraid you wouldn't want to string with me anymore."
"That's your excuse?" Fredericks sounded on the verge of tears.
I didn't know what to do."
"Fine." Orlando felt as though he had left his body, like he was just a cloud of anger floating free. "Fine. I guess you're not dead or anything. That's what I called to find out in the first place."
"Orlando..."
But this time he was the one who hung up.
"They're out there. So close you can almost smell them. No, you can smell them in a way. The suits pick up all manner of subtle clues, extending the human sensory range so that you can feel nearly a score of them moving toward you through the fog, just the way a mastiff can scent a cat walking on the back fence. You look around, but Olakoff and Poon Yi still haven't returned. They picked a bad moment to check the signaling equipment at the landing site. Of course, there aren't many good moments on this hellhole of a planet. Something moves out on the perimeter. You focus the filter lenses in your helmet. It's not a human silhouette. Your hand is already extended, your gauntlet beam primed, and it takes only a flick of thought to send a horizontal thread of fire razoring toward the intruder. The thing is fast, though. Horribly fast. The laser tears another piece off the wreckage of the first expedition ship. But the thing that had crouched in front of it is gone, vanished back into the mist like a bad dream. Your suit sensors suddenly blast into alarm mode. Behind you, half a dozen loping shapes. Idiot! You curse yourself for being distracted, even as you turn and throw out a coruscating tangle of fire. The oldest trick in the book. These things hunt in packs, after all. For all their resemblance to Earth crustaceans, the creatures are terrifyingly smart. Two of the creatures go down, but one of them gets back up and drags itself to shelter on one fewer jointed leg than usual. Illuminated by the residual fires from your assault, it darts a look at you as it goes, and you imagine you can see an active malice in the strange, wet eyes.
Malicious giant bugs!
Orlando's finer sentiments went into revolt. This was the last time he'd ever trust a review from the bartender at the Living End. This kind of crap was years out of date. Still, he'd paid for it. Or rather, his parents were going to when the monthly net bill was deducted. He might as well see if it got better. So far, it was a pretty standard-grade shoot-'em-up, with nothing that appealed to his own fairly particular interests.
There's a fireworks burst of light along the perimeter. Your heart leaps. That's a human weapon.
Olakoff and Pugny. You rake a distant section of the perimeter to provide cover for your comrades, but also to let them know where you are. Another burst of fire. Then a dark figure breaks into the clearing and sprints toward you, pursued by three shambling, hopping shapes. You don't have a very good angle, but you manage to knock one of them down. The pursued figure flings itself forward and rolls over the edge of the trench, leaving you an unencumbered shot at the things following it. You widen the angle, sacrificing kill power for coverage. They are caught, jiggling helplessly in the beam as the air around them superheats. You keep it on them for almost a minute, despite the drain of battery power, until they burst into a swirl of carbon particles and are carried away on the wind. There is something about these creatures that makes you want to kill them deader than dead.
Something like what? Do they try to sell you memberships to religious nodes? How bad could they be? Orlando was having trouble keeping his mind on the simulation. He kept thinking of Fredericks. No, he realized, not about Fredericks so much as the gap where Fredericks used to be. He had thought once that it was strange to have a friend you'd never met. Now it was even stranger, losing a friend you'd never really had. Olakoff crawls toward you down the length of the trench. Her right arm is mostly gone. There is a raw-looking blister of heavy plastic just above her elbow, where the suit has sealed off at the wound site. Through the viewplate, Olakoff's face is shockingly white. You cannot help remembering that planet fall on Decamer One. That had been a good time. You and Olakoff and 10 days' leave. The memory rises up before you. Olakoff as she emerged from a mountain lake, dripping, naked, her pale breasts like snowdrifts. You made love for hours, with only the trees as witnesses, urging each other on, knowing that your time was short, that there might never be a day like this again.
Pugny! They got him!
She moans. The terror in her voice snaps you back to the present. The atmosphere distortion is so great that even this close, you can barely hear her voice for the noise on the channel.
Horrible!
Decamer One is light years away, forever lost. There is no time to help her, or even to humor her. Can you shoot? Do you have any charge left in your gauntlet?
They took him!
She screams, furious at your seeming indifference. There is something irreparably broken in her voice.
They captured him. They've taken him down into their nest. They were putting something through his eyes as they dragged him away.
You shudder. At the end, you'll save the last charge of the gauntlet for yourself. You've heard rumors of what these creatures do to their prey. You will not allow that to happen to you. Olakoff has slumped to the ground, her shivers rapidly becoming convulsive. Blood is dripping back from her injured arm into her helmet. The seals are not working properly. You pause, unsure of what to do. Then your suit sensors begin to shrill again. You look up to see a dozen many-jointed shapes, each the size of a small horse, skittering toward you across the smoking, debris-strewn planetary surface. Olakoff's sobbing has become a dying person's hitch and wheeze.
Boss! Hey, boss! Let those poor imitations alone. I gotta talk to you.
Damn it, Beazle, I hate it when you do that. It was just starting to get good.
And God knew distraction had been hard enough to come by during the last week. He looked around at his cot with irritation. Even without the trophies, it still looked pretty dismal. The decor definitely needed to be changed.
Sorry, but you told me you wanted to know if you had a contact from that wicked tribe group.
They're on the line?
No, but they just sent you a message. You want to see?
Orlando suppressed his irritation.
Yes, damn it, play it! A congregation of yellow squiggles appeared in the middle of the room. Orlando frowned and brought up the magnification. At the point where he could see the figures clearly, they had very poor resolution. Either way, squinting at the fuzzy forms made his eyes hurt. The monkeys hovered in a small orbital cloud. As one of them spoke, the others went on smacking each other and flying in tight circles.
"Wicked tribe, we'll meet you,"
said the foreground simian, melodramatic presentation belied by the pushing and shoving in the background.
The spokesmonkey wore the same cartoonish grin as all the others, and Orlando could not tell whether the voice was one he'd heard before or not.
"Wicked tribe will meet you in special secret tribe club bunker in treehouse."
A time and note address flashed up, full of childish misprintings. The message ended. Orlando frowned. "Send a return message, Beazle. Tell them I can't get into treehouse, so they either have to get me in or else meet me here in the inner district."
"Got it, boss."
Orlando sat himself in midair and looked at the NBC window. The little digging drones were still hard at work, pursuing their goals with mindless application. Orlando felt strange. He should have been excited, or at least satisfied. He had opened up a connection back into treehouse. But instead, he felt depressed. "They're little kids," he thought. "Just micros, and I'm going to trick them into doing... what? Breaking the law? Helping me hack into something? And what if I'm right, and there are big-time people involved in this? Then what am I getting them into? And for what?" For a picture. An image. For something he had seen for just a few moments, and which might mean anything, or absolutely nothing. But it's all I've got left. End of side 17. To continue, turn the cassette over.
Side 18. City of Golden Shadow. Otherland, Volume 1. By Tad Williams. Continuing on page 555. It was a closet. He could tell that by the slightly musty scent of clothing and the faint skeletal lines of coat hangers revealed by the light seeping in from the crack beneath the door. He was in a closet, and someone outside was looking for him. Long ago, when his parents still had visitors, his cousins had once come for Christmas. His problem had been less obvious then, and although they asked him more questions about his illness than he would have liked, in a strange way he had been pleased to be the center of attention, and had enjoyed their visit. They had taught him lots of games, the sort that solitary children like himself usually only played in VR. One of them was hide-and-go-seek. It had made an incalculable impression on him, the feverish excitement of hiding, the waiting in the dark, breathless, while it hunted for him. On the third or fourth game, he had found a place in the closet off his parents' bathroom, cleverly deceptive, because he had to remove and hide one of the shelves to fit into it, and had remained there, undiscovered, until the Ollie Ollie Oxenfree had been called. That triumphant moment, hearing the surrender of his distant enemy, was one of the few purely happy memories of his life. So why, then, as he crouched in the darkness while something fumblingly investigated the room outside, was he now so terrified? Why was his heart pattering like a jack-lighted deer's? Why did his skin feel like it was trying to slide all the way around to the back of his body? The thing outside, whatever it was, for some reason he could not imagine it as a person, but only as a faceless, shapeless presence, surely did not know where he was. Otherwise, why would it not simply pull open the closet door? Unless it did know, and was enjoying the game, reveling in its power and his helplessness. It was a thing, he realized. That was what terrified him so. It wasn't one of his cousins or his father, or even some baroque monster from the Middle Country. It was a thing. An it. His lungs hurt. He had been holding his breath without realizing it. Now he wanted nothing more than to gasp in a great swallow of fresh air, but he did not dare make a noise. There was a scraping outside. Then silence. Where was it now? Standing just on the other side of the closet door, listening, waiting for that one telltale noise, and most frightening of all, he realized, was that other than the thing outside, there was no one else in the house. He was alone with the thing that was just now pulling the closet door open. Alone, in the dark, holding a scream clenched tight in his throat, he closed his eyes and prayed for the game to end.
"I brought you some painkillers, boss. You were jerking around a lot in your sleep."
Orlando was having trouble getting his breath. His lungs seemed too shallow, and when he did manage at last to draw deeply, a wet cough rattled his bones. He sat up, accidentally dislodging Beazle's robot body, which rolled helplessly down onto the bed covers, then struggled to right itself. It was just a bad dream. He sat up and looked around, but his bedroom didn't even have a closet. Not that old-fashioned kind, anyway. It had been a dream. Just the kind of stupid nightmare he had on bad nights. But there had been something important about it. Something more important even than the fear. Beazle, now set on rubber-tipped legs once more,
began to crawl away down the quilt, back toward its nourishing wall socket.
Wait.
Orlando lowered his voice to a whisper.
I think I need to make a call.
Just let me lose the legs, boss.
Beazle clambered awkwardly down the bed frame, heading for the floor.
I'll meet you online.
The doors of the Last Chance Saloon swung open. An axe murderer politely dragged his victim to one side before returning to active dismemberment. The figure that stepped over the spreading puddle of blood had the familiar broad shoulders and thick weightlifter's neck. Fredericks also had what seemed to be a certain wariness on his sim face as he sat down. He, Orlando, felt a kind of despair. She?
I got your message.
Orlando shook his head. I just didn't want to... He took a breath and started again. I don't know. I'm pretty scorched, but mostly in a weird way. Know what I mean? Fredericks nodded slowly.
Yeah, I guess.
So what do I call you?
Fredericks.
That was a tough one, huh? A smile briefly touched the broad face.
Yeah, but I mean, you're a girl, but I think of you as a guy.
That's okay. I think of myself as a guy, too, when I'm stringing around with you. Orlando sat quiet for a moment, sensing that this particular unexplored country might be treacherous.
You mean you're a transsexual?
No. His friend shrugged.
Sometimes I get bored being a girl. So when I first started going on the net, sometimes I was a boy, that's all. Nothing unusual, really.
Fredericks did not sound quite as certain as he or she might have liked.
But it's kind of awkward when you get to be friends with someone.
I noticed.
He said it with his best Johnny Icepick sneer.
So do you like boys? Or are you gay or what?
Fredericks made a noise of disgust.
I like boys fine. I have lots of friends who were boys. I have lots of friends who were girls, too. Shit, Gardner, you're as bad as my parents. They think I have to make all these life decisions just because I'm growing breasts.
For a moment, Orlando felt the world totter. The concept of Fredericks with breasts was more than he was able to deal with at the moment.
So that's it? You're just going to be a guy? I mean, when you're online?
Fredericks nodded again.
I guess. It wasn't a total lie, Orlando. When I'm hanging around with you, well, I feel like a guy.
Orlando snorted.
How would you know?
Fredericks looked hurt, then angry.
I get stupid and I act like the whole world revolves around me. That's how.
Against his better judgment, Orlando laughed.
So what are we supposed to do? Just keep on being guys together? I guess so.
Fredericks shrugged. If you can handle it. Orlando felt his anger soften a little. There were certainly important things he hadn't told Fredericks, so it was hard to sustain much self-righteousness, but it was still difficult to wrap his mind around the idea.
Well, he said at last, I guess...
He couldn't think of any way to end a sentence that wouldn't sound like a bad Netflix. He settled for, I guess it's okay then. It was an incredibly stupid thing to say, and he wasn't sure it was okay, but he left it at that for now. Anyway, this all started because I was trying to find you.
Where have you been? Why didn't you answer my messages?
Fredericks eyed him, perhaps trying to decide if they had found a kind of equilibrium again.
I was scared, Gardner, and if you think it's because I'm really a girl or some fen-fen like that, I'm going to kill you.
Scared of what happened in Treehouse?
Of everything. You've been weird ever since you saw that city, and it just keeps getting more and more scanny. What's next? We try to overthrow the government or something? We wind up in the execution chamber for the cause of Orlando Gardnerism? I just don't want to get into any more trouble.
Trouble? What trouble? We got chased out of Treehouse by a bunch of old Akisushi. Fredericks shook his head.
It's more than that, and you know it. What's going on, Gardner? What is it about this city that's got you so obsessed?
Orlando weighed the choices. Did he owe something to Fredericks? Some kind of honesty? But his friend had not told him anything of his own secret voluntarily. It had been Orlando who had ferreted out the truth.
I can't explain. Not now.
But it's important.
I just know it is. And I think I've found a way to get us back into Treehouse.
What? Fredericks shouted. The other patrons of the Last Chance Saloon, used to death rattles and agonized shrieks, did not even turn to look.
Go back? Are you scanning to the uttermost degree?
Maybe. He was finding it hard to get his breath again. He turned down the volume for another body-shaking cough.
Maybe,
he repeated when he could speak again, but I need you to come with me. You're my friend, Fredericks, whatever you are. In fact, I'll tell you one secret anyway. You're not just my best friend. You're my only friend.
Frederick's brought hands to face, as though to block out the sight of a world in pain. When he spoke, it was with doomful resignation.
Oh, Gardner, you bastard. That's really unfair.
Chapter 29. Tomb of Glass. Netfeed Entertainment. Blackness wins Palme d'Or. Visual, Ostrand accepting prize. V.O. Pekka Ostrand seemed unsurprised at winning the grand prize at this year's Nîmes Film Festival, although most of the other insiders on the beaches and in the bars were stunned. Ms. Ostrand's 4-hour film, Blackness, which except for low-light effects and subliminal sonics, contains nothing but the blackness of the title, was considered too miserablest to please the usually conservative judges.
Visual, Ostrand at press conference.
Ostrand,
it is what it is. If you tell some people about smoke, they want to see the fire, too.
One moment, there was only the light of the fire Khabu had built, a soft red glow which left the corners and high places of the lab their mysteries. Then, following a series of clicks, the overhead fixtures sprang back on, washing white brilliance into every cranny.
You did it, Martine!
Leenie clapped her hands.
Every Pinetown resident's dream. Free electricity.
I can't take all the credit.
The humble deity's voice now echoed from the built-in wall speakers, filling the room.
I could not have done it without Mr. Singh. I had to get past some very formidable power company security before I could redistribute the electricity usage information to hide the trail.
That's all very nice, but can I go now and do some goddamn work?
Singh sounded genuinely irritated.
This entire folly presupposes me being able to get through Otherland's defenses in the next few days. So if I don't manage to crack that, all this means is that you found yourselves some really ugly-looking bathtubs.
Of course, said Reenie quickly.
She definitely wanted and needed to stay on the old man's good side. She thanked him and Martine again, then let them disconnect.
You can close the outside door and take the jack out of the car phone, she announced to Jeremiah, who had been waiting on the now-functional phone at the entrance. We have electricity and data lines now, and they should both be untraceable.
I'm doing it, Reenie.
Even through the small pad speaker, she could hear the outside door beginning to grind down. A moment later, he came back on.
I don't like seeing that door close. I feel like I'm being locked in the tomb.
Not a tomb at all,
she said, ignoring her own quite similar impressions.
Unless it's Lazarus' tomb you're talking about, because this is where we're finally going to start fighting back. Come downstairs. We've still got a lot of work to do.
She looked up to see her father watching her. She thought he looked scornful.
Well, we are going to fight back, and we're going to see Stephen back among the living again, Papa. So don't give me that look.
What look? God help me, girl, I don't know what you're talking about sometimes.
As soon as the lights had come back on, Khabu had put out the fire. Now, as he stirred the last few embers with a stick, he turned to Reenie.
There have been many things happening, he said, happening very fast. Perhaps we should sit and talk, all of us, about what we will do next.
Weenie considered, then nodded.
But not now. I'm really anxious to get these V-tanks checked out. Can we do it this evening, before bed?
Khabu smiled.
If anyone is the elder upon whose wisdom we rely, Weenie, here in this place it is you. This evening would be a good time, I think.
The preliminary news seemed to be even better than Weenie had hoped. The V-tanks, although cumbersome compared to more recent interface devices, seemed to have the potential to do what she needed, allow her long-term access and much more sophisticated sensory input and output than anything she had used at the Poly. Only an actual implant would have been better in terms of responsiveness, but there were some advantages to the V-tanks that even an implant couldn't match. Because they seemed to have been expressly developed for long-term use, the tanks were fitted out with feeding, hydration, and waste processing equipment, so that with only occasional assistance, the user could be almost completely independent.
But what is that stuff?
Her father stared into the opened casket, his mouth twisted in distaste.
Smell like something foul.
It's gel.
She reached her hand down and touched it with her finger.
At least it will be.
Long Joseph cautiously extended one of his own calloused digits and tapped on the translucent material.
This is no jelly, or if it is, it's all dried up and nasty. This is some kind of plastic.
Reenie shook her head.
It needs to be hooked up properly. You'll see. When you run a very mild current through it, it gets harder or softer, colder or warmer, in any part of the gel you want. Then there's the micropumps. She pointed to the array of pinprick holes on the inside wall of the tank, to adjust the pressure. And the processors, the computer brains of the thing, will sense whenever you push back against the gel. That's the output part. That's why it makes such a good interface. It can mimic almost anything in a simulation. Wind on your skin, rock under your feet, humidity, you name it.
He looked at her with a mixture of suspicion and pride.
You learn about all this stuff at that school you went to?
Some of it. I read a lot about this plasmodal process because for a while it was going to be the next big thing. They still use it for other industrial stuff, I think. But most of the high-end computer interfaces now are direct neural connections.
Long Joseph stood up and regarded the 10-foot-long tank.
And you say that you put electricity in here? Right in this thing? In the jelly?
That's what makes it work. He shook his head.
Well, girl, I don't care what you say. Only a fool climbs into a bathtub full of electricity. I won't get into something like that ever.
Weenie's smile was a little sour.
That's right, Papa. You won't.
It had been a very successful afternoon, Weenie thought, with help from Martine, who had maintained her connection to whatever, no doubt quite illicit, source of information had brought them here in the first place. They had begun to understand how the V-tanks could be made ready. It would not be easy. Weenie figured it would be several days' worth of hard going, at least. But in the end, they should be able to make the things work. The military had done more to help them than simply leave much of the equipment in place. The automated systems that had kept the underground location safe from intrusion, until now anyway, had also kept the air dry and the gross machinery of the place in working order. Several of the tanks had still suffered damage from neglect, but Weenie had no doubt that if they cannibalized a few parts, they could get at least one, and perhaps more, online. The computers themselves, which would supply the processing power, were hopelessly old-fashioned, but they were the biggest and best of their day. Weenie thought that by a similar process of robbing Peter to pay Paul, they could get enough CPUs working that a software alteration or two, something else they would need the old hacker Singh to accomplish, would enable them to get the power and speed necessary to make the V-tanks perform. She scraped her spoon in the bottom of the bowl, finishing off the casserole Jeremiah had made, and risked a small sigh of content. Prospects were still bleak, but they were far less hopeless than they had seemed a few days ago.
Rini, we said tonight we would talk.
Even Khabu's quiet voice echoed in the huge, empty dining room.
We're just about out of food, for one thing, Jeremiah reminded her.
There must be emergency rations here somewhere, Rini said. This place was built during the first Antarctica war scare, I think. They probably made this place capable of being self-sufficient for years.
Jeremiah gave her a look of undisguised horror.
Emergency rations? Do you mean meat cubes and powdered milk? Horrid things like that?
Do you remember what happened to you the last time you tried to use your card? You can only use cash so many times before someone notices, especially outside the inner city. Not that we have much cash left, anyway.
So what does that mean?
He pointed to the casserole dish.
No more fresh food?
Weenie took a breath,
struggling to be patient.
Jeremiah, this is not a holiday. This is serious business. The people we're after killed Dr. Von Blake.
He gave her an angry, pained look.
I know that.
Then help me. The whole point of being here is to give us a chance to get into this other land.
I still think it's crazy, her father said. Come all this way, all this work, just to play some computer trick? How all this going to help Stephen?
Do I need to explain it again? This other land thing is a network. An incredibly big and fast VR network like no other. And it's also a secret. A secret people will kill for. It belongs to the people who hurt Stephen and a lot of other children. The people who murdered Dr. Von Blake and probably firebombed our flat and got me fired from the poly. Not to mention all of Mr. Singh's friends who worked on it with him and are now dead. These are rich people. Powerful people. No one can get to them. No one can take them to court. And what would we say even if we got them there? All we have are suspicions. And pretty crazy-sounding suspicions they are, too. So we need to get inside this other land. If something about that network is the reason for what's happened to Stephen and other children, if they are using it to run black market organ farms, or as the centerpiece of some kind of child pornography cult, or something we can't even imagine yet, some kind of political power play, or cornering the world market in something, then we need to get proof. She looked around the table. At last, even her father was being attentive. Rini felt a rare moment of confidence and control. If we can get a V-tank up and running, and if Singh can crack Otherland's network security, I'm going in with him. The tanks are meant to work long-term, with very little maintenance. That means there won't be much for the three of you to do once I've got my IVs and oxygen going. Maybe just check on things every now and then. I think that Khabu alone should be able to do that.
So what about us? Asked her father. Just sit around while you playing in your jelly bath?
I don't know. I guess that's why we need to talk. To plan.
What about Stephen? I'm supposed to sit here while that boy's still sick in the hospital? That quarantine thing not gonna last forever.
I don't know, Papa. Jeremiah's worried about his mother, too. But remember, these people don't hesitate to kill when they need to. At the very least, if you got caught outside, you'd both get picked up and detained. She shrugged. I don't know anything else you can do except stay here. During the long silence that followed, Rini looked up to see Khabu watching her. He had a strangely abstracted expression. Before she could ask him what he thought, a beep from the wall speaker made them all jump. I have found some more information about the tanks, Martine announced, and have downloaded it to the laboratory memory. Also, Sagar Singh called me to say that he has hit a rough patch, as he calls it, and says that you should not get up your hopes he will be able to help you with the tank software. What does that mean? I am not sure. The security system is very complicated for this Otherland network, and it is not very much used, so he finds it hard to work without attracting attention. He says it is only a chance of 50-50 he will be able to break in. Rini felt her insides sink. I suppose we've never had odds much better than that with any of this, from the start. But he also said that if he can do it, you must be ready to go very quickly. Wonderful. So he won't be able to help us, but we have to get the tanks ready right away. Martine's laugh was rueful. Something like that, yes. But I will help as much as I can, Rini. You've already been more help than I can say. Rini sighed. Her buoyant spirits had collapsed, punctured by reality. We all will do what we have to do. Martine, I have a question, Khabu said. Is it true that the data lines from this place are shielded, that they will not give us away if we use them? Shielded is not what I would say. I have routed them through various nodes, which feed them through randomly chosen outgoing lines. That way, a trace will only follow them as far back as the last node, and there is no obvious connection from that node to the original source. It is a common practice.
What does all that mean? Asked Long Joseph.
So we can use the lines going in and out of here, even to ship data? Khabu seemed to want something clarified. Yes, you should still use them responsibly. I would not call telemorphics or UNCOM and taunt them. God, no, Rini said in horror. Nobody around here is going to ask for trouble, Martine. We already have enough. Good. Does that answer your question?
It does, Khabu nodded.
Why did you want to know that?
Rini asked the small man after Martine had ended her call. For one of the first times since she had known him, Khabu looked uncomfortable.
I would prefer not to say at this moment, Rini, but I promise you I will not do anything irresponsible, as Martine warned.
She was tempted to push him for an answer, but felt that after what they had been through, he deserved her trust.
I didn't think you would, Khabu.
If the phone lines are safe, I could call my mother, Jeremiah said eagerly.
Rini felt a heavy weariness.
I think that falls under the heading of asking for trouble, Jeremiah. If they've managed to put a hold on your cards, then they've also probably managed to get a tap on your mother's phone line.
But that Martine said the calls couldn't be traced.
Probably.
Rini sighed again.
Probably. But she also said don't ask for trouble, and calling a number that's almost certainly tapped is asking for trouble.
Jeremiah's face darkened in anger.
You're not my master, young lady. You don't tell me what to do.
Before she could reply, and it would have been with some heat, Khabu spoke up.
Rini is doing her best for all of us. None of us is happy, Mr. Dako. Instead of being angry, perhaps there is some other solution.
Grateful for his intervention, Rini followed his lead.
That's a good idea, Habu. Jeremiah, are there any of your relatives we could reach through a public kiosk?
She knew that in Pinetown, among those who couldn't afford a regular data line service, many people used the communal kiosks and would fetch whichever neighbors were being called.
I doubt they'd tap every single kiosk near every one of your relatives. We haven't been declared public enemies, so this stuff has to be done fairly quietly.
As Jeremiah paused to think, his anger diffused. Rini smiled at Habu, letting him know she appreciated his help. The little man still looked troubled.
We have two tanks that are complete, said Habu.
Rini turned from her inspection of one of the objects in question. She had been testing a handful of rubber-sheathed fiber links which hung from the tank's lid like the tentacles of an octopus dangling from a rock crevice.
I know. That way we have a backup if something goes wrong with the first one.
Habu shook his head.
That is not what I mean, Rini. We have two. You are thinking that you will go by yourself, but that is not right. I have accompanied you before. We are friends.
You want to break into this other land system with me? For heaven's sake, Habu, haven't I got you into enough trouble already? In any case, I'm not going in by myself. Sing's going, and maybe Martine as well.
There is more to it than that. You are exposing yourself to more danger. Do you not remember the Kali? We have stood by each other, and should do so again.
Rini saw by his stubborn look that this would not end quickly. She let go of the snaky fibers.
But
she suddenly could not think of an argument. More, she realized how much better she would feel if Habu did accompany her. She still felt compelled to make a token protest.
But who will take care of things out here if we're both online? I told you, this could last days, maybe weeks.
Jeremiah is intelligent and responsible. Your father is also capable, if he understands the importance. And as you said yourself, there is not much that needs to be done, except to monitor us.
So it's us already?
She couldn't help but smile.
I don't know. I suppose you have as much right as I do.
My life, too, has been caught up in this.
The small man remained serious.
I have made the journey with you willingly. I could not turn back at this point.
She felt suddenly as though she might cry. He was so stern, so grave, and yet no larger than a boy.
He had taken on her responsibilities as though they were his own, seemingly without a second thought. That kind of loyalty was so strange as to be a little frightening.
How did this man become so dear to me so quickly?
The thought bloomed with surprising force.
He's like a brother my own age, not a child like Stephen who needs to be looked after.
Or was there more to it than that? Her feelings were confused.
Okay, then.
She turned back to the fiber links, afraid that the warmth in her cheeks might show, might send him some sign she did not wish sent.
You asked for it. If Jeremiah and my father say yes, then you and I go together.
I still say you crazy girl, her father said.
It's not as dangerous as you think, Papa.
She lifted the thin, flexible mask.
This fits over your face. It's not that different from what a diver wears. See, there's a place where it locks down over your eyes. That's so the retinal projection stays focused. Retinal projection just means it shoots a picture onto the back of your eye. That's pretty much how you normally see. So it makes the visual input feel very real. And here's how you breathe.
She pointed to three valves, two small, one large, that made a triangle.
This fits over your nose and mouth, a very tight seal, and the air is pumped in and out through these tubes. Simple. As long as you and Jeremiah keep an eye on the air mixture, we'll be fine.
Long Joseph shook his head.
I can't stop you, so I won't even try. But if something goes all wrong, don't you come blame it on me.
Thanks for that vote of confidence.
She turned to Jeremiah.
I hope you've been paying attention anyway.
I'll keep a close eye on everything.
He looked at the wall screen a little nervously.
You're just testing it now, right? You're only going in for a short while?
Maybe as little as 10 minutes. Maybe a bit longer. Just to make sure we've got everything hooked up properly.
She stared at the taped bundles of fiber links stretching between the two tanks and the old-fashioned processors.
Keep a close eye on the vital function readings, okay? I've tested everything as well as I can, but even with Martine and her schematics, there are so many damned hookups, I'm not certain about anything.
She turned to Habu, who was rechecking his own tank, connection by connection, just as he had seen her do.
Are you ready?
If you are, Rini.
Okay. What should we do?
some simple 3D manipulations, like the ones I used to teach you back at the Poly? Those should be comfortably familiar.
Certainly. And then perhaps something else.
Like what?
Let us wait and see.
He turned away to unkink mask connectors, which had surely been unkinked long before. Rini shrugged.
Jeremiah, can you turn on the tanks now? The main power switches?
There was a click, and then a quiet hum. For a brief instant, the overhead lights flickered. Rini leaned forward to stare into the tank. What appeared to be hard, translucent plastic filling 3/4 of the tank turned foggily opaque. A few moments later, the substance went clear again, but now seemed to be a liquid. Tiny ripples appeared in its surface, thousands of them in concentric whorls like fingerprints. But before she could make out the larger pattern, the ripples subsided.
"How are the readings?"
she asked. Jeremiah opened a series of windows on the wall screen.
"Everything is right where you wanted it."
He sounded nervous.
"Okay, here we go."
Now that the moment had come, she was suddenly apprehensive, as though poised at the end of a high diving board. She pulled her shirt over her head and stood for a moment in bra and knickers, looking down from the edge of the tank. Despite the warmth of the room, she felt her skin go pebbly.
"It's just an interface," she told herself. "Just input-output, like a touch screen. You let your father and his electricity in the bathtub get to you, girl."
Besides, this was going to be a lot easier than when they did it for real. No catheters, no IV lines, and only down for a short time. She pulled the mask over her face, inserting the plugs into her nostrils and positioning the flexible bubble with its built-in microphone over her mouth. Jeremiah had already started the pumps. Except for a faint metallic coldness, the air tasted and felt quite unexceptional. The hear plugs were easy, but it was a little more difficult to get the eyepieces centered properly. When she finally got them locked down, she lowered herself into the tank by touch. The gel had reached stasis, skin temperature and the same density as her body, so that she floated weightless. She slowly stretched out her arms to make sure she was centered. The edge of the tank was beyond the reach of both hands. She was hanging in the center of nothing, a small, collapsed star. The darkness and silence were absolute. Rini waited in emptiness for Jeremiah to trigger the initial sequence. It seemed a long wait. Light leaped into her eyes. The universe suddenly had depth again, although it was an unmeasurable gray depth. She could feel a subtle pressure shift as the hydraulics tilted the V-tank upright to its working angle of 90 degrees. She settled slightly. She had weight, although not much. The floating sensation was replaced by a gentle sensation of gravity, although the gel could adjust that back to weightlessness or whatever else a simulation might call for. Another figure appeared, hovering before her. It was a bare-bones sim, little more than an international symbol for humanoid.
"Habu? How are you feeling?"
"Very strange. It is different from the harness room. I feel much more as though I am in something."
"I know what you mean. Let's try it out."
She flashed a few hand commands and created a darker gray plane beneath them that stretched to a putative horizon, giving the empty space an up and down. They settled onto the plane and felt it flat and hard beneath their feet.
"Is that the bottom of the tank?" asked Habu.
"No. It's just the gel hardening where the processors tell it to harden. Here."
She summoned up a ball the same color as the ground. It felt quite substantial beneath her fingers. She deliberately softened it to the consistency of rubber. The processors obliged.
"Catch!"
Habu reached up and plucked the ball from the air.
"And this, too, is the gel? Hardening where we are supposed to feel an object?"
"That's right. It may not even make a whole object, but just give us the correct tactile impressions on our hands.
And when I throw it,"
he lobbed it underhand back to Rini,
"it is analyzing the arc that it should make, then recreating that, first in my tank, then in yours?"
"Right. Just like what we did in school, except with better equipment. Your tank could be on the other side of the earth, but if I can see you here, the substance in these tanks will make the experience fit."
Habu shook his rudimentary head in appreciation.
"I have said it before, Rini, but your science can indeed do wonderful things."
She snorted.
"It's not really my science. Besides, as we've already seen, it can do some pretty dreadful things, too."
They created and arranged a few more objects.
checking the calibration of the tactor system and the various effects, temperature, gravity, not available on the Polly's more primitive harness system. Rini found herself wishing she had a more sophisticated simulation to work with, something that would give her a real idea of how the tanks could perform. Still, it had been a good first day.
"I think we've done what we needed to," she said. "Anything else you want to try?"
"Yes, actually." Khabu, or his featureless sim, turned to face her.
"Do not worry. I have something to share with you."
He waved several hand commands. The gray universe disappeared, dropping them into blackness.
"What are you doing?"
she asked, alarmed.
"Please, I will show you."
Rini held herself still, fighting hard against the urge to thrash around, to demand answers. She did not like letting someone else control things. Just when the wait seemed interminable, a glow began to spread before her. It started as a deep red, then broke into marbled patterns of white and gold and scarlet and a deep velvety purple. Broken by this glaring brilliance, the darkness formed itself into strange shapes. Light and dark swirled and commingled. The light grew steadily brighter in one spot, coalescing at last into a disk so bright she could not look at it directly. The dark areas took on shape and depth as they settled to the bottom of her field of vision, like sand poured into a glass of water. She stood in the middle of a vast, flat landscape, painted in harshly brilliant light, broken only by stunted trees and the humps of red rocks. Overhead, the sun smoldered like a white-hot ingot.
"It's a desert," she said. "My God, Khabu, where did this come from?"
"I made it."
She turned, and her surprise deepened. Khabu stood beside her, recognizably himself. Gone was the impersonal sim from the military lab's operating system, replaced by something very close to her friend's own small, slim form. Even the face, despite a certain smooth stiffness, was his own. Khabu's sim wore what she guessed was the traditional garb of his people, a loincloth made of hide, sandals, and a string of eggshell beads around the neck. A quiver and bow hung from one shoulder, and he held a spear in his hand.
"You made this? All of this?"
He smiled.
"It is not as much as it seems, Rini. Parts of it are borrowed from other modules on the Kalahari Desert. There is much free gear available. I found some academic simulations, ecological models, evolutionary biology projects, in the University of Natal databanks. This is my graduate project."
His smile widened.
"You have not looked at yourself yet?"
She looked down. Her legs were bare, and she too wore a loincloth. She had more jewelry than Khabu, and a sort of shawl of hide that covered her upper body, tied at the waist with rough twine. Remembering that they were supposed to be testing the V-tanks, she fingered it. The cured skin felt slithery and a little tacky, not unlike the thing it was supposed to be.
"That is called a karas."
Khabu pointed to the place where the shawl gaped at the back.
"The women of my people use it as much more than a garment. Nursing babies are carried there, and also forage discovered during the day."
"And this?"
She held up the piece of wood clutched in her other hand.
"A digging stick."
She laughed.
"This is astonishing, Khabu. Where did this come from? I mean, how did it get onto this system? You couldn't have done all this since we got here."
He shook his head. Sim face grave.
"I copied it from my storage at the Poly."
Rini felt a clutch of alarm.
"Khabu, I had Martine's help. Just to be safe, we shipped it through, what did she call it? An offshore router. And I left you a message."
"What are you talking about?"
"While I was in the Poly system, I left a message on your account there. I said that I had been trying to reach you, and hoped to speak to you soon about my studies and my graduate project."
Rini shook her head. She heard tinkling and reached up to touch her dangling earrings.
"I don't understand."
"I thought that if someone was looking for your contacts, it would be good if they thought I did not know where you were. Maybe then they would not persecute my landlady. She was not a pleasant person, but she did not deserve the sort of trouble we have had. But Rini, I am unhappy."
She was finding it hard to keep up.
"Why, Khabu?"
"Because I realized as I was leaving the message that I was deliberately telling a lie. I have never done that before. I fear that I am changing. It is no surprise that I have lost the song of the sun."
Even behind the mask of his simulation, Rini could see the small man's discomfort.
"This is what I was afraid of."
She could think of no comfort to give him. With any other friend, she would have argued the ethics of the useful lie.
the self-projecting falsehood. But no other friend would feel a lie as a sort of physical corruption. She could not imagine anyone else in her life despairing because he could not hear the son's voice.
"Show me more,"
it was all she could say.
"Tell me about this place."
"It is only just begun."
He reached out and touched her arm, as though to thank her for the distraction.
"It is not enough to make something that looks like the home of my people. It must feel like it as well, and I am not yet skilled enough for that."
He began to walk, and Rini fell in beside him.
"But I have made a small piece, in part to learn the lessons that come from mistakes. Do you see that?"